I'm Andrew Walmsley, and welcome to a landmark episode of Photography Insights. Yes, we are now on show 150, and so much has happened in these 3 years I've been doing this. I mean, we've all been through dark times, but it's great to see life in the UK working its way back to normal. It really has been an emotional time recently, and I can feel it with my guests and myself too. I admire the courage it's taken everyone to keep going, especially in a fragile industry like art. So well done all, and keep fighting away. Today I'd like to introduce Joni Sternback, an artist, photographer and filmmaker from the USA. We had a long time speaking about coming on, and Joni kindly reached out recently, and I was so pleased to have her lady on for this episode. Joni has a keen interest in surfing and shoots using large format cameras using the Tintype process. It's an amazing thing to be doing with such large cameras, requiring everything darkroom related to be with you and taken back too, so there's a lot to think about. She talks to us about her experience over a few decades, I'll not tell you how many, around the theme of surfing, the people and surfboards. Joni's experience doesn't just come from shooting that, but other genres too, and she's got some lovely street work on her website called Passengers, so please do check that out. It's just unfortunate we didn't have time to discuss it. Luckily though, we fit some time in to discuss the world of abandonment and why we love it so much. So in this one, abstract, the female perspective, surfing, change, learning with your husband, 16 by 20 cameras, and Quinn Jacobson. And there'll be links to her website and Instagram on the website. Before I move you on, let's thank the friends of the show as always. So that's Steve at Chroma Camera, Dave at Film Dev, and Pete at Static Age. And obviously Steve's still working away on a load of new things, and you'll be able to get to see him at the photography show, NEC in the UK, if anyone's going to that. I've had some recent work developed by Film Dev, so I've just started putting a couple of those up. It's just a few sort of family photos from sessions with expired film. And obviously Static Age has got some more zines on the go, so if you get your pre-orders in there, that'd be very nice. And as I said on last week's show, I'm carrying on to do a couple more shout outs of reviews from recent guests on the show. So here is another one that's come through on iTunes from Michael Schneider. And this one's entitled Talented Interviewer, Great Content. Andrew Walmsley, aka the Vlogger, is a talented interviewer who's deeply passionate about photography in all of its forms and approaches. His long-form approach to podcast production is refreshing, and he has interviewed some of the most interesting photographers of today. I thoroughly enjoyed working with him and listening to his content. I mean, it's just so nice to hear words like that. Michael's a very experienced guy. He's got, films out there, his photography, he travels all over, he's doing his science bit and trying to tell people about what's going on in the world. It's just so nice. So thank you so much, Michael. And there should be some more next week. There's also been another Ko-fi donation, so I'd like to thank the unnamed person for that. Like I say, every pound dollar counts, so I do appreciate every single thing that anyone can do. It helps keep me in film or buy new little bits and try new chemicals. It's all really nice for me. And obviously, you'll see more and more articles the more things I try. So thank you again, and if you do want to do anything, you can do that through the website, and there's a link in the corner. And obviously anyone who wants to help in any way, Get the message out about the show, share it on social media, leave a Google review. So that's if you ever are using Google for your search engine, if you just put in flogger.co.uk on the right-hand side, sort of where the map and adverts are, you can just click on reviews and just write, a quick review there. Anyone who listens to the podcast can leave it on iTunes or the built-in podcast app on an iProduct. And anyone who doesn't have access to anything like that, there's always Facebook reviews. So please do just check out my page there. It's just facebook.com/flogger/reviews. So it's nice and easy. Thank you for everything, everyone. And let's move ahead, roll the music, and await our lovely guest, Joni, for episode 150. And welcome to the show, Joni.
Hi, thank you so much, Andrew. It's so great to be here.
Finally, I know it's took some time, but I really did appreciate you contacting me. It's really
Oh,
cool.
well, I was a little neglectful about my email over parts of the pandemic, so I keep the emails I need to respond to unread, and eventually I go and look at the unread ones. And there you are.
Now, what you say? So, no, I think that's really nice because, like you said, I sometimes think this is the way things are supposed to be.
Yeah, they flow in real time, not so much in, the time we want them to flow in.
Exactly. And the good thing is, this is actually going to be show 150.
Wow, congratulations to you.
Oh, thank you. So, yeah, it's nice. I celebrated 100 because that was like a massive landmark. It felt, and it seems, like a couple of months ago.
Yeah, now you're on your way to 200.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm still a long way off, Mr. Prello at Candid Frame. But there you go. He's got a lot more years on me. But no, I appreciate you spending the time, and I know how busy how everybody is, so it's really
Oh,
appreciated.
well, no problem at all.
And obviously, I came across your work such a long time ago, when I started looking at things like surfing and alternative processes, and I found it really interesting because it's a lovely process, but you're a female shooting this as well. So I thought it would be really interesting to get a female point of view, really.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to provide a female point of view.
I think it's really nice. I have had one surfer on, actually.
Who?
Vanya Zask.
I don't know if I know her, but
Lovely, still doing it. Surfs with the children. She podcasts as well now. So, an absolute fabulous person, very funny. Yeah, and she shoots film still while
Oh,
surfing.
where's she based?
She's West Coast.
Of England.
No,
Oh.
America. Yeah, she's a California lady,
Wow.
yeah. Yeah, she does. I think she's into like Mexico. I think she's surfing way down at the minute. She's literally there at the minute. She's just like wild camping.
There are a bunch of people
Is it?
who drive down and they're, like RVs or, converted
Yeah.
vans, and surfing is big in Mexico along the coast there.
I think the number of projects you've worked on was interesting, and it's nice to see your theme is this surfing thing, but you've actually done other work as
Yeah,
well,
lots of other work.
haven't you?
I began Surfland in 2006. But basically, I'd say, there's my early work, but then I feel like this whole trajectory that I've been on has happened since 1999, and it was very ocean-centric. And so the ocean has sort of been leading me to make pictures, if there is such a crazy thing as that.
Because obviously you saying you've been in photography a long time, so you've obviously seen different mediums come and go. So what made you turn into this surfing type person then? Because obviously you've done street photography, you've done all sorts, haven't you?
Yeah, so basically, this is my story of how I kind of switched gears. I kind of fell out of love with photography. I actually moved to England in 1995, and we lived there
Okay.
for a year. And I, right before I left, I had lost my teaching job. I had been dumped by my gallery. Like, I was just really in shit shape, as they say. And I was just very disenchanted with kind of the whole sort of trend in photography that I felt like did not really embrace what my work was about at the time, which was, medium format color narrative photography based on marriage, motherhood, maternity, and not about, it wasn't really a postmodern kind of point of view. It was to some degree, but not in the sense that others were, other people's work was. So when I came back from England, I was just really quite down and felt like, I don't have anything to say. So why say anything in photography? And so I began to make watercolor drawings that I ended up using photographs to make. So they're drawings that are made from photographs. But the process of just sitting down with watercolor, and I was a fine art student in my early days, so I had some drawing skills, I guess, stored up in there. And I just did that for like a year, until I sort of felt like, I think I know what to do with photography now. Like, I felt like what I was trying to do with photography was, well, one thing was I had a very feminist-based point of view, but the other thing is I was trying to kind of convey emotion. And I felt that it was really difficult to convey emotion through a narrative image. So this is an image that I would set up and, create like a tableau. But I felt like they were really contrived looking in a way, and that they did not really convey the emotion that I felt I wanted to convey. So I started photographing the ocean because I felt that the ocean was this place where you could just project whatever you want onto this huge open space. And you can, and in return, you would receive whatever it was that you needed, so to speak. So I ended up making these very abstract photographs or semi-abstract photographs of the ocean surface for, I think I did this for like, I don't know, 4 years until I finally got bored staring at a tiny little space in the ocean. And then I lifted the camera up and included the sky. So then I had a, then I was faced with, the Hiroshi Sugimoto syndrome, which is, how do you look at the division between the sea and the sky without thinking of his work? So I changed my perspective based on the fact that I didn't want to be, I wasn't doing the same thing he was doing, so didn't want to be thought of in that same way. So I now changed my frame to have like, 4/5 sky and 1/5 ocean. And so during this time, I was out there, I was still photographing the ocean and the sea and the sky. And I had my 8x10 camera and perched on the same bluffs I'd been perched on for the last, 6 years, all by myself, trying to figure out what the hell I was doing and how to make an emotional photograph. And suddenly, well, before I say the suddenly, So when I arranged the frame, there were surfers in my frame because, the ocean was just so gorgeous where they were, and I couldn't avoid them. Like, this was not the first time they were in my frame, but this was a time they were in my frame when I kind of came to terms with it in a more positive way. And I'm photographing. I take one picture and it's just all gray out there. There had been a storm. And then suddenly the light comes through the clouds in this way that I refer to as a Dutch landscape. The whole sea lit up with this light show that I have never seen before in my life, nor have I seen it since. And I could hear everyone in the water cheer. And I felt in that moment, wow, like I am with these people. I am, like, we're all like having this moment of awe.
Moment.
And this photograph turned out to be like this spectacular picture because the right side of the picture is black with darkness from the storm. The left side of the picture, the left corner frame, the upper left corner frame has this light coming through, and the rays of sun are like streaming onto the water. And it's just, something that you just had to be there to witness, except that you could see it in this photograph, and it's quite powerful. So this was the moment in 2012 when I felt like I had a relationship with surfers because I am not a surfer. I'm an ocean lover, but I'm not a surfer. So yeah, so that was kind of like, wait, did I say 2012? I meant 2002. And then by 2006, I had already learned the wet plate process, and I had gone back to that very same bluff, where I had shot that other photograph, because that's like, my bluff of good luck or something, my bluff of inspiration. I don't know what it is. And I'm there, and I, again, it's another gray, crappy day, humid, disgusting, middle of the summer. And I make a picture and it's just awful. And then along the bluff where I am, there's a path, and there was this guy walking, and he turned out to be a photographer, so he's chit-chatting us, and we're talking, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh yeah, I'm just waiting for a surfer." He said, "Well, I'm a surfer." I said, "Really? Well, would you mind going down to the bluff, I mean to the beach, and like standing there with your surfboard so I could make a tintype of you?" And he said, "Oh no, I don't like to be in front of the camera." So his girlfriend was with him, and she smacked him, and she said, "You're gonna do it." Meanwhile, the camera's like, I don't know how many feet away, like hundreds of feet, like this big in the image. But so he goes down the bluff, he agrees to do it. I said, "When you get down there, just stand still until I give you the thumbs up, and that's when the picture will be done." So he comes, goes down there, and like I said, it's a gray day, everything's gray, and he puts on a white rash guard, which was like, oh, so brilliant, because there was no contrast in this photograph except for that white rash guard. He holds his board in front of him, faces me, sort of not the image I had expected it to be, but that was the only way he could see me to get the thumbs up. So I had sensitized my plate during the time it took him to get down off the bluffs and to, get his surfboard and get the rash guard on. And he stands there, and I think I exposed for like, I don't know, 5 seconds, something like that. He holds his pose. I give him the thumbs up. He goes into the water. I never see him again. I develop the plate, I fix the plate, and my assistant and I look at each other and we go, wow. And then the project was born.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, it's a
Just
fun
one
moment.
moment.
And then I had to go down to the beach where there were surfers, and I was terrified. I felt like I didn't know anything about surfing or surfers, and they commanded a big part of that beach. So I was, taking up a certain amount of space with my dark box, my chemicals. I didn't know how it would work out, but it did work out.
God, that's amazing, isn't it? So, oh, this is sort of caused by accident in theory, then, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, chance, accident, spontaneity, all of the above.
Yeah, that's so nice though. It just shows it's become like a natural thing for you to do then, isn't it?
Yeah, so like, you know what, that could have just been a one-off, but I felt like there were many more instances where surfers had come into my frame when I was photographing the ocean and like I'm out there by myself and you know like in foggy weather and then there out of the fog come these surfers. You know, it was just like, what are they doing in my frame and why can't they move over? But you know, it sometimes it takes multiple meetings to understand that this is something you should pay attention to.
Yeah, because I suppose a few people have had that. I've seen a few people shoot, and there's been, say, yachts or sailing boats in the background, and you must be thinking, God, why are they in my shot? I'm trying to get a nice clear shot, maybe of, like you say, of separation between, say, land and sea and or sky, and it's like, yeah, to then think of using that as your actual subject.
Yeah, exactly. You know, sometimes I think there's a lot of, you know, single-mindedness. You know, you're trying to focus, you're trying to stay, you know, on point, but sometimes just looking a little to the left, a little to the right can show you something that maybe you would be happy if you had paid attention to.
Yeah, I mean, this is honestly such a common story in the sense it's luck, circumstance, or whatever, by an artist, and then it leads to amazing projects you like. Like I said to you earlier, you're waiting for your chance. When am I going to find this? And I totally understand that because it's like you think, I've been out there. I don't know, I've done street photography and architecture, I've worked with models, and it's started happening to me, so I feel I'm starting to understand this a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I was just so completely committed to photographing the ocean in this one spot in Montauk. And, you know, the bluffs have really eroded since the time I began making these pictures to now. Like the bluff where I once stood is not there any longer. So, you know, like the beaches have gotten so crowded. Like all the things that were easy for me to do and made it possible for me to do, they're not really there anymore. Where the world has changed and it's harder to get a parking spot. It's, you know, all these things are more difficult. And so, you know, at least for me, like, you know, I have a family. I had during this time, you know, I had, you know, younger kids, so limited time to go and you know, all the way out to Montauk to make these pictures, to hire an assistant. All these things were factors in my making this work. And, you know, so yeah, they're not so favorable anymore, I'd have to say.
That just shows then maybe it is when you find your time, you need to do it and take advantage.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, it's a nice message for us to think about. Because I'm sure most listeners would be the same. Not everyone's an artist. Some of us are only practicing and learning as we go. But there are some people like yourself that listen in and are artists themselves. So I know people love hearing the stories behind the work because we could talk about technology, techniques and processes all we like, but that's only a means to an end, really, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, when I started doing the ocean pictures, I had taken a workshop and learned wet plate collodion at that time. And so, hang on one second. Hey, Eric. So I had learned wet plate collodion. And like when I had first learned it, like, first of all, I was terrified of it. Like, all I could remember is like, oh, you could, you know, inhale a heavy metal, you could, you know. You could explode yourself, you know, you could create, you know, a certain kind of gas that'll kill you. So like, okay, well, I'm afraid. And it took me years just to kind of have a place to work with it, you know, that wasn't in my home, and then to, you know, practice well enough so that I could make a plate that, you know, wasn't filled with mistakes, you know, that weren't intentional, you know, to, you know, like it's one thing if you want to, you know, have your plate look a certain way intentionally, but like I was trying to have a clean looking plate and I was trying to, you know, get a handle on the medium so I understood it better. And it took forever because I could only work in little pockets of time because it's so time consuming. So all those things kind of factored into how long it took me to get comfortable with the medium and then to, you know, take it outside of my little garden to the real world where, you know, I would, you know, put it in my car and go places with it. And, you know, creating my kit was like, you know, that was, you know, required a lot of refinement and troubleshooting and and lists. But, you know, it's all part of, you know, how you think, how you grow, who you want to be, and, you know, how you're going to get there.
Yeah, well, I think the thing is, it's a very difficult process to learn in one sense, because like you're saying, you know, you had kids, so you're thinking of safety at home, but, you know, you want your hobby and maybe turn it into something, but It's not a digital camera that you just go to a cupboard, pick it on, bang, you can go. It's not a film camera you can just load and set off, is it? It's an entirely different thought process.
Yeah. My husband and I learned the process together. So we were able to have a conversation or many conversations. We're still having conversations about it. And so, you know, but it is a, it's like a very physically demanding process and labor intensive. So there's, to be honest, like, you know, I wasn't young when I learned it and I'm not young now. So there's like a limited amount of time that you, that I feel I could work with this process. I like, it's fantastic and you fall in love with it and then you're kind of hooked. But, you know, I'm not that hooked anymore. I mean, I still do it, but I don't, I mean, I used to get out there every May and go to the beach and, you know, wait for surfers to appear, but I don't really do that anymore. So I'm trying to, look at new things.
There's nothing wrong with that. No, I mean, that's life, isn't it? You move on to something else. I do think it's an amazing process. We have had on the show, master, wet clothing photographer. Do you know Quinn Jacobson?
Oh yeah, I mean, I've never met him, but of course I know him.
Yeah, he's absolutely fabulous human. I still sometimes watch him. He does live YouTube every week, and sometimes I'll just pop onto the show and just say hello.
Yeah, you know, Quinn really made a name for himself in terms of workshops and education about wet plate. You know, and just having video, YouTube videos, you know, the people we learned from, like the guy I learned from, you know, leads a 19th century lifestyle. I mean, yes, he has videos, but like by the time the videos came around, you know, it took a long time, in other words, for John Coffer's videos to, you know, be available. You know, when I studied with him, he didn't really even have a written manual at that point. He just had a few handouts. So like, things develop over time and, you know, and people change, but, you know, like I said, John leads a 19th century lifestyle. So you're not going to be, you know, texting him, "Hey John, you know, what's going on with my silver path?"
He's not going to do a YouTube live or anything soon.
Well, maybe he is, but only if somebody else is bringing the gear.
It's different.
Everybody really is different in how they interact with the wet plate world, with the world in general. Is interesting. It's a bit of a comedy.
and I think alternative processes and historic processes, I think bring out some very different people and the forums and Facebook groups and all that. They're lovely. Some people, I think, want to really help each other because it seems like a niche thing. Mm-hmm.
They really have. I mean, especially when I first started and the wet plate world was very tiny, especially in New York, I was like doing a workshop and I had all my gear on Long Island where I keep it. But I was doing a workshop in Manhattan and I had forgotten the ferrous sulfate for the developer. And there was this guy in Chelsea, Michael Mazzio. And I called him up and I said, oh, you know, I'm Joni Sternbeck. You know, I'm wondering. He said, I've heard of you, Joni. I said, you have? He said, yeah. I said, would you be willing to loan me or sell me some ferrous sulfate? He said, yeah, come on over. You know, and that's the way it was, you know, like people were just, they were friendly. They were helpful. And when I went to Australia and met Craig Tuffin, you know, like I tried to find out how many people in Australia are doing wet plate collodion. And there were three. One was a workshop in Sydney. The other was a commercial guy near Sydney. Neither one of them were helpful. But then like through my chemist, my chemical supplier, I found out about Craig Tuffin and I wrote him and he said, Joni, how can I help? And yeah, we're lifelong friends now.
Oh, see that's the amazing thing, isn't it? I think when you get introduced to these people, that's when you see the other side of people, I think.
Yeah, so it's been, you know, this project that I've been working on for so long has introduced me to so many wonderful people, surfers, surfboard shapers, photographers, you know, assistants, you know, just random people on the beach. It's really been a journey, horsewomen, horsemen, cowboys, cowgirls. I mean, it's really been an expansive journey that, you know, has just been thrilling.
I mean, that's great. It must be nice. I mean, one thing we must ask then is like, how was it to shoot being a female in these environments? Was it ever an issue? Were you the only female? What was it like?
Well, you mean in the surf environment? You mean photographing?
Photographing, really.
Well, I had a friend come and help me because I wanted to shoot larger plates and I didn't have the gear for that. So I had a friend come and shoot with me and he brought some of his gear and he helped me. So he kind of worked the dark box and I worked the camera. And, you know, we made some great pictures. And at the end of the day, he said, you know, only a woman could do these pictures. I couldn't do these pictures. A guy couldn't do it. And I said, well, what do you mean? And I think that there is perhaps a non-threatening aspect to a woman working with a big camera on the beach versus a guy. And there, okay. I mean, I had never thought of that before, but you know, he comes from a male perspective and maybe he knows, you know, he's been out there by himself with a big camera. And you know, when you're out there alone and you run into people or you're trespassing or you're doing any of those things, you know, people are not, you know, unlikely to come over and say hello. There's this video of Sally Mann where she's like photographing in the South somewhere. She found some landscape she really liked and she pulls up her car and she's like in the dark box. And I guess she's either pulling her plate into her camera back or developing it, one or the other. And she hears the click of a gun behind her. Wow. And she gets a little nervous and she has some very clever response to the gunman. And, he uncocks his gun and she comes out and they have a conversation. But, you know, there are times when, you know, you're like, you're in the dark box and you don't know what's behind you, and it's a little scary. Maybe it's better to be a woman.
Yeah. I suppose I can understand that sometimes. Because, like you say, I think certainly men, I suppose men and women can be a bit more kinder to females in that sense. I mean, I've had a chance when we were shooting during harvesting season, and we went to go do a field of the hay bales. You know, it's a very common thing over here with the round hay bales, and they look beautiful in sunsets. So we went to a field, we could see a farmer in the distance at the bottom of the field, and we waved, and then we just walked towards like a nice line we liked. And next thing you know, it was quite a while. We took a few shots. He drove up in his big 4x4 and then made me, it was an awful conversation, made me very uneasy, and then threatened us and said, "Can you see what I've got in the back of my car?" And he had a rifle, and he suggested we get off his land. And then he was like accusing us of trespassing. And I thought, well, yeah, technically we are, but we're just taking pictures of the hay bales. You're driving a car on your field. I'm on foot. I'm not damaging anything. And we just says, right, no problem. We will leave you to it. But he just thought, oh my God, that's not, I don't know. You know, we're not stealing anything.
You're trespassing, and to some people, that's just the end of the story. And
Yeah. And I understand that trespassing is trespassing at the end of the day. But you'd never meet anyone if you didn't. So
yeah, if you don't take any chances, you won't get chancy pictures.
No, exactly, yeah. I mean, I'm doing this project where I'm shooting abandoned things. And I've got a lovely place I go to that's local to me. And I was in this shell of a building, and someone had left like a kid's sit-on motorbike. It's just a plastic one. Probably like a 2 or 3 year old be using. And I loved it, because you think, but against all this abandonment of brick walls, it's just sat there and it's in pretty good condition. And it just feels so real. So I was taking a photo of it, and then I could hear a noise, and I was like, oh God, it's the farmer. And he has not just a bad reputation, because it's factual. He has shot people and handicapped them for life.
Oh my God.
He's been imprisoned, and he does not like trespassers.
Yeah, I wouldn't go to, I would, okay, that's one place taking a chance is not worth it.
And luckily it wasn't him, it was someone who looks after his land. So I just thought, oh no then, and you know, I played it down, we had a nice conversation, and ended up trying to ask him if I could have a look around the rest of the land. I was really pushing it. But you know, there's some beautiful old like tractors, and they've got like trees growing up through them. It's just amazing for photography in the right light.
Well, I share your interest in photographing abandoned things. There's something, you know, about the way the past can tell a story that that can do it, like, in, it just can do it in a way that is unlike any other. And it's so textural and it's so rich with history. So I find it really interesting too.
As long as I've got enough film, I'm happy. But I've started with others. So I did a little bit of 4x5. So that was my venture into large format. So it's not quite as big as anything you've used, is it?
Well, you know, I still work with 4x5, although I haven't used it, my 4x5, in a while. I kind of like go through camera phases. I mean, so with wet plate, I work with an 8x10 camera mostly. That's my kind of go-to camera because, you know, an 8x10 Tintype it's a decent size for a direct positive for, you know, a unique image. Mm-hmm. It's not too small, but, you know, it's also not that big if you think about it in terms of an artwork. artworks are nicer when they're a little larger. So making larger plates just kind of became the next challenge after I had many years of making 8x10 tin types. So, right now I have a friend's Hasselblad, and when I got my first 810, I sold my Hasselblad, and I've been sort of bereaving it ever since. So I'm borrowing my friend's Hasselblad. I'm having so much fun with it. I love it. It's like, oh God. I told him he had to sell it to me. I don't know if he will.
Oh, fair enough. I know a few people have done that, but I know quite a few of my friends that they like the medium format, that style. I think there's something for everyone because I think some people love TLRs. Personally, never shot with one. I'm happy what I have. I'm not a camera geek. I don't get envious of other people's stuff, and I'm not into collecting stuff I'm not going to use. Got 135 mil, one medium format, one 45. Often I've only got one lens, so I've got what I've got. That's it.
I have to say, having a limited amount of gear gets your eye trained the best way. So for years I had an 8x10 Deerdorf and I had a 300 millimeter lens, and that was what I used. There was no other lens, And your eye really learns what the frame is going to be like. You can be in any situation. And because you've shot in with that lens so many times, you can see it. You can see it before you have to drag your camera out. And that's a
Yeah,
really important
you're right.
thing to know how to do as a photographer.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I'm exactly the same with medium format. I think that's all important, but I think shooting a big a larger size is something that's really started appealing to me, and it's why I was keen on trying my 45. But even when I shooting that, I was like, because I print 8x10 as a minimum, you think even that's not very big, like the same as what you're thinking. And then I'm like, and my friend had just got a 4x5 after we started talking about it, and he went, "It's your fault I've bought a 4x5." But he's actually really good with it. And I said, "You know what, mate?" I says, "You're going to be looking at an 8x10 already soon." And then he messaged me and says, "I already have been, actually." And I said, "I know, but we can't do it because the jump in cost
Know.
is absolutely
I
ridiculous."
know. It is insane for film, especially. The other thing is when I was photographing the ocean, I used an 8x10 camera, but then I used a 5x7 reducing back. So all my holders were 5x7. And it was a lot easier to carry all that gear with the 5x7, with all the 5x7 film holders as opposed to 8x10. So that made a big difference too. There's only so much a person can carry on their own. And it's nice to have some options. But I find a 4x5 just like, oh, it's like almost like a point and shoot at this point, So it's so easy to set up. It's so easy to, to pop the film holder in. It doesn't even feel that big, really.
It's funny that because as someone who's mainly shot 35 and a lot of medium now, you think 4x5 is just massive. It's such a slow process. It's hard work. So it's funny hearing your perspective in that sense. But I'm getting used to it. Although, because I'm an occasional shooter in that sense, so the last time we shot it was my friend with his 4x5. He took pictures of me, and then I wanted to take some of him. And I was using such stupid slow film. We didn't think it would work because if we was indoor and it would have been a 15-second exposure. And he said, I said, "Do you think you can do it? Keep still that long?" And he says, "Probably not, but he says, let's try it." So we did it. Guess what I forgot to do?
Open the
Take the dark
Oh,
slide out.
no.
But we didn't realize till the next day. He messaged me and he went,
Ooh.
I don't think you took the dark side out, did you? And I went, oh no, I didn't. So he's got a nice photo of me and I ain't got one of him.
That's funny.
That's life though, isn't it? I mean, I think it's interesting that you're using this process. So, you know, when you're setting up out there, then what sort of back room bag are you using? Can you
What
describe
sort of
it?
what?
You know, like a dark area, because obviously you've got to do this while you're out on site, haven't you? Make your photo.
You mean what is my dark room like?
Yeah, so obviously when you're out at the beach, what do you take with you to make a dark room?
Oh, okay. Well, I have my tripod and camera for like to take the pictures. Then I have a portable dark box which fits in the back of my car. It by portable, it stays in one piece. It doesn't collapse, but it fits in the back of my car, on the back seat of my car, and it's just basically a like a 36 by 24 inch box that is about 12 inches deep with a dark cloth over it. Then there's a table, folding table for that dark box. And then there's a big plastic container that holds my film, and I'm using air quotes here. My film is the blackened aluminum that I use to make the tintype. Then I have a cooler, just a regular cooler that you use for the beach. It's a little higher than some, and so all my bottles of liquids fit in the cooler along with my silver tank. And
Because
all the various
you're
sundries,
in
right?
a very,
And then
yeah,
I have
bright
these
place.
shoe boxes that stack, and those are used to house each tintype after it's been exposed, developed, fixed, and slightly washed, and then it's kept in the shoe boxes till I take it home, and then I can wash it properly.
Okay. So is it what's your box made of then? Your
It's made
dark
of foam
box.
core and wood.
Right, okay. Because I've seen different approaches to this because I've interviewed a few tintype people as well. There's Justin in New York. I think he started with like a cardboard box, put the hands in back of his van, and then he would park up on the streets in New York and do pictures out on the street. But then he's developed it into a bit of a better enclosure.
Yeah, so there's a couple of different kinds of dark boxes. Some where you just put your hands in and you can look through a wind like a you know like a like a filtered window, so you don't have to smell the stuff. But I find it's like a I don't have any lab experience doing things like that, so it's a much more out of body experience for me rather than being inside the box myself, my whole body along with the necessary equipment. So yeah, then I have a blanket that I put everything on, and an umbrella to keep myself in the shade, and just all the various sundries that go into making a wet plate kit.
It's a fair bit of kit really, isn't it? A fair bit of weight as well.
Waist, a
Weight.
weight, yes. There is waste as well, so I use for that. I use, basically these big kitty litter containers that used to hold kitty litter. They hold a lot of liquids, and then I cart it back
Right.
with me, so I leave no trace.
That's good, yeah. Yeah, because a lot of stuff is dangerous, let's face it, isn't
Yes,
it?
not something you want to leave with you. So, yeah.
It's really interesting because, you know, you can understand why you've really had to think about this from a point of being a mother, a female, and just a photographer, because it's not 2 seconds to set it up. It's not 2 seconds to expose, is it? It's a big process.
It is. It is. It's it's involved, but that's part of what makes it so incredible and so, kind of engaging.
Yeah, do you think that's why you've enjoyed doing the project for so long then? Because you're not focusing on, right, I tell you what, today I'm going to shoot 50 of you, right, get here, right, one, go, two,
Yeah,
next. Because you can't do
not
that.
really. I mean, I at a certain point I was like making appointments and meeting people at the beach, and I kind of screwed up in terms of the time frame that it would take for one picture to the other, because sometimes I can shoot a person every 15 minutes, but it doesn't always work that way. So
Yeah.
it's just it just really depends. Basically, I like to go to the beach with whomever I'm going to photograph, and then that's the day. Nobody else.
No, I think that's nice, yeah. Because you want to be chilled and achieve something rather than something you're happy-ish with. It's not the same, is
Yeah.
it? I think one good photo is better than 10 mediocre in it, sort of thing.
Yeah, at a certain point, like I had this, like I would go, and usually I'd make a few good pictures, and then one day I went and I didn't make one good picture, and I was like, oh God, I'm cursed. And then like I went back, and then like I ran into somebody, and we did three shots, and by the third shot, that was it. And I said to my assistant, let's go, we're done. We're leaving. We got it.
I
Let's
know what
not
you
be
mean, yeah.
greedy. And then I also just learned not to push because, I come from New York. I live in the city. I know how to push, when you're tired, when things seem like, oh, let's just do one more. I found with this process, pushing does not work. It's kind of the wrong thing to do. And so it gave me
Yeah.
something different to kind of lean on, the idea of less rather than more.
Yeah, I think it's a lovely approach. I think it's far more important. I mean, I like the way through your work, you've captured the board as well. It seems like some people just shoot, say, portraits of surfers or surfing, but you seem to have captured a bit of the person, but also like the history of it through the board.
Yeah, so in the last 2 years, I have been focusing mostly on photographing surfboards. And just from one particular place and location, I just felt like I needed to do something a little different. And, I needed also to kind of take it off the beach. The beach, there's a lot of wear and tear in the sunlight. And I wanted to say something else, and I wanted to say something a little less definite and a little more abstract again. And I felt that I could speak a lot more about surfing and the history of surfing through the board rather than through the individual.
And I think it's a nice approach that you're not a surfer yourself, but it still comes across. If I'd have looked at your work, I went, oh, she's definitely a surfer.
Well, that's what a lot of people think, and I don't mind them thinking it. I only wish I were a surfer.
It's not a bad thing. So it just shows how good your images are in that sense.
Well, thank you.
No, it's cool. So, is culture a big thing in like the boards and the surfing then? Because it appears like they're completely different, some of these pictures. Okay, so do you think culture is a big thing in surfing?
What kind of culture? Surf culture? Well, I would say from my experience that surf culture is very important for surfers, especially. It's less important for me, but it is there, and I do love surf culture, but I'm not sure what you mean in terms of like hierarchies or race or any of those things.
Yeah, I'm thinking probably more of terms of regions of America, because are they all shot in one place, these?
No, they're shot
No, okay.
all around the globe.
Right, okay. So did you see differences then, say, between surfboards in one country to another, or the surfers themselves?
That's a good question. I don't know that I, sadly, I don't think I can answer that honestly, because the only place I really paid, there are two places I paid the most attention to surf culture, and that is here in Montauk at my home break and in California at Rincon. Those are the two places I photographed most consistently. And there was definitely different cultures between East and West Coast. Not specific. I mean, no, what I mean to say is not exclusively, but I did notice on the West Coast a certain type of surf culture that I did not see here on the East Coast. I think it's also somewhat geographical or geological, or how the beaches are formed and what people can do on the beaches. But I definitely saw sort of a maybe we would say a more gnarly side of surfing in California than I ever saw on the East Coast of the United States.
No, that's cool. I mean, it's different places, it's different temperatures. I mean, climate, it's everything, isn't it? I mean, I like them because, like, so some of your shots are not just, say, one person. I mean, for instance, there's, one of the shots has got, oh, I don't know, seven, eight, nine people, like, in the distance, all holding up. And that, to me, it's not a portrait of the culture or anything like that. It's, I don't know, it's, is it symbolism of the sport? Is it, what's the other word? It's like a leading line, so the symmetry there. I mean, it's really nice.
I think it's all of the above. It's anything. A lot of times what I do is dictated by the equipment and the weather that I'm and the people that I'm working with. And I think maybe the photograph you're referring to, I made with a 16 by 20 camera, and I only shot with it like three or four times, and it was, I had more challenges with that camera, obviously, than any other camera. And the lens that I used was not really a lens that I could make a sharp photograph of somebody close up. So I chose to have people in the distance. And when you choose to have people in the distance, you're creating a geometry and a shape. And so that's really what those pictures were about. There's also this very classic idea of surfers in the lineup and being along the horizon. And so it's something that, is very relatable. So there's that.
It is, it's lovely. But even the others where you've got a little bit closer, I think there's six people and one person's got a board on the head, others standing sideways, some are obviously moving forward. That it's another different perspective. It's very nice.
Yeah, I think that image that you're speaking about is one that I photographed in California with an 11 by 14 camera. And that was for a movie. It was a still for a movie called The Women in the Waves. And so it was a group shot. It was always meant to be a group shot. And so there are various ways to do group shots. And I chose like kind of the three that I'm kind of most attracted to. I think one is, a lineup along the edge of the horizon. The other was a triptych with two to three people in each image, forming a very large image. And then the last one was all of the women in a body of water connecting to one another. So,
Oh wow. Yeah, really nice.
yeah.
I mean, some of the others though, there's like a little girl stood on, I mean, it could be anything. Could it be a pier? Maybe a 5-year-old, 4-year-old, something
Oh,
like that.
she's on a truck.
Oh, is it a truck? Because it's, yes,
She
flatbed
is a
truck, isn't it? Yeah, that's right.
two-year-old
2 year old.
who held
Wow.
still for 1 second. It was amazing. Yeah, some of the pictures that you pulled up I had made in Hawaii. I did a shoot in Hawaii in 2017, and it was the first time I'd been to Hawaii, and it's the last big shoot that I have done for the body of work, Surfland. And I just felt like, wow, I just kind of touched the surface. I want to go back. But I was supposed to go back, and then the pandemic hit, and here we are, 2 years later, or a year and a half.
Yeah, one of them things. Do you think you'll try and get back
I'd
there?
love to. I really would love to, but we'll see what happens. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair enough. It's one of them things, isn't it? I also thought what was really nice is you do the same style sort of work for this abandoned stuff that I was talking about earlier, but I think it's like a unique way because you're doing something that is a slower process. They nearly are, well, they are long exposures in the traditional sense, aren't they?
Oh, those are very long exposures. They were photographed in some very dark places, and they required very long
Right.
exposures. Whereas the surfing photographs, the exposures had to be a lot shorter in order to get sharp pictures of people's faces. But photographing the abandoned series really helped me to, get out there on the road with my camera and gear and make pictures I was happy about with this process. So that was important.
I think so, yeah. Think it really works as well. The images I picked out then, how big a camera was you using for these?
Well, so for those, I used a lot 4x5, 5x7, and then full plates, which is 6.5 by 8.5. I mean, I had
Wow.
dedicated wet plate cameras made by a camera maker back then, but unfortunately, those cameras are not great for travel unless you're traveling by car. So I ended up, my husband gave me a Deerdorf camera that he had, and then I had a wet plate back adapted for it specifically. So that became my main camera, and then I got rid of all the other cameras.
I see, yeah. I really like them because it's got a very different look to them. I mean, you can see you've got a different eye to some people as well.
Yeah, I made those pictures just post 9/11 and at a time when, the freedom to put a tripod on the streets of New York City or in any of those environments was a lot easier.
Right.
And a lot of the things that I photographed are gone. There's a pier on the West Side Highway of New York City that had burned down, and it was just this metal skeleton shape and on the Hudson River, and it was spectacular. And I think a year after I made those pictures, that was removed, and it was just so beautiful. I don't know why they just didn't leave it. It was so great. But yeah, a lot of the pylons I photographed eroded, just a lot of those things are gone, and that's just the way it is with abandoned things.
Yeah, but then you've kept that memory alive through your photograph and obviously your memory of it as well, isn't
Yes,
it?
true. There's one house that I photographed over a series of years that is still there. It's called, I think it's called, Broken Home. It's like on stilts in the water.
Oh, yeah, that's lovely, that
Yeah,
shot,
that's
yeah.
still there, but that's one of the few.
Mean, it's an unusual site as well, and I think that's what sometimes attracts some of us. Because I've looked at loads of abandoned stuff over the years. It's something I got into when I first got into photography, and I think it's not just the history of seeing something, but I think it's something so different. Looking at a windmill over here is ordinary in one sense, that there's a lot of them. But to actually get into one that's just been left is really interesting.
It is. It tells a story, and the stories are not always good stories. You know, the stories are
No.
not always pretty. You know, they might be a really interesting picture, but they're not always about a pretty or pleasant history in, you know, in the course of a nation. Like, I went down south to Georgia, and I ended up finding these abandoned ruins, and turns out they were made of tabby, which is a mixture of like seashell and concrete. And these were slave ruins that I discovered. And I couldn't believe it because they're like on this upscale housing development. And just the irony of it all, and the fact that they're not preserved by the historic register is kind of crazy because they're just, you know, they're just going to fade away even more.
I know what you mean. Yeah, I mean, the area I live is full of old World War II airfields.
Oh, wow.
What I'll do is I'll put links into your website so people can check you out. My final quick question then is, I do this pay it forward scheme. Is there anyone you would recommend whose work I should look at, or even maybe for a future interview?
I see. Is there somebody in, like, is there like a category you have in mind or no?
The more weirder, different, fascinating, or someone you just really admire, honestly, at.
Well, there's three women who I have a like a critique group with, and
Okay, yeah.
where all of our work is somewhat different or very different, but all of their work is fantastic and really, really, I think, kind of groundbreaking. One woman is Joanne Dugan, and she photographs, or she, well, she doesn't actually photograph, she makes photographs, abstract photographs in cyanotype and in gelatin silver, and then collages them together to create larger works. We're both represented by the same gallery, Black Box Gallery in London. And the other woman is Cheryl St. Ange. She's based in New Hampshire, and she's been making, over the last few years, she's been making photographs of her aging mother with dementia and created this very
Okay.
intense and emotional body of work. And then there's Lori Lambrecht, who's out in Bridgehampton, Long Island. And she has a former life as a professional knitter. She had a knitwear company, and she has managed to bring embroidery and weaving and knitting into her photographic work. And
Wow.
so they're all really different, but they all are really working with textual, you know, elements. And I think, you know, I think it'd be great if you check them out. Their work is wonderful.
No, that's cool. Thank you so much for that. So, all I can say is thanks a lot, Jenny. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. It's been really nice hearing how your work was formed as well.
Well, thank you for listening and for inviting me, and I send you my best regards from Long Island.
No worries. I'll leave you to it, and thanks again.
Okay, ciao.
Hey, I just wanted to say thank you so much for listening to that episode. I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed interviewing. Please don't forget, if you want to get involved, I'm starting to put out there on social media the list of guests for that week. You are welcome to submit any questions you want to ask, and hopefully I'll read them out for you. Whether you want to do that through Instagram, direct message, you can just click, if you click on the direct message bit, there's a button there and you can record and send that right across. There's many apps you can do, or email me, or send me a DM on Facebook, Instagram, whatever. That's cool with me. For those of you who want to support the show, please don't forget, iTunes reviews are always appreciated. And obviously, I will read them out the following week for you, and I tend to use them on social media, so that's all very much appreciated. If you'd like to help contribute towards the show, then don't forget there's my coffee page where you can submit anything from $1 a pound or upwards, and I'll keep a note on there what I'm trying to achieve as the months and years go by. For those who want to keep coming back to the show, don't forget you can just subscribe in your friendly podcast app of choice, and there's a weekly newsletter on my website, flogger.co.uk, so that's PHLOGGER, and you'll get an automated email from me, and that tells you each week what's gone up on the website, so it's the podcasts and any articles I've wrote. So yeah, thank you so much, and I'll see you again soon. Bye.